This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. On Monday, the Biden administration announced that it had repatriated Abdul Latif Nasser out of the Guantanamo Bay detention facility and back to his home country of Morocco. Nasser was held at Guantanamo for nearly two decades. U.S. officials accused him of fighting with the Taliban against the U.S. military in Afghanistan in 2001. But Nasser was never charged with a crime, and he was approved for release from Guantanamo back in 2016. But that never happened, a sign of the deep-seated political disagreements that have hung over the detention center since it was first used to hold detainees starting in 2002.
It's important for Americans and others across the world to understand the kind of people held at Guantanamo. These aren't common criminals or bystanders accidentally swept up on the battlefield.
For many years, it's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security. It undermines it. It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit.
This morning, I watched President Obama talking about Gitmo, right? Guantanamo Bay, which, by the way, we are keeping open, And we're going to load it up with some bad dudes, believe me. We're going to load it up.
Do you think that you will succeed in getting Guantanamo Bay closed?
That is my hope and expectation.
But 39 detainees still remain at the facility, only 11 of whom have actually been charged with war crimes. And according to the New York Times, U.S. taxpayers are paying $13 million per Guantanamo detainee per year. Now, we'll have more coming up on the Biden administration's approach to releasing detainees from Guantanamo. But first, we want to focus on a more personal aspect of Abdul Latif Nasser's story. In February 2020, the WNYC podcast Radiolab released a multi-part series called The Other Latif, in which the show's co-host, Latif Nasser, reported extensively on the man whose name he shares. Now that the subject of his series has been released, we want to check back in with Latif Nasser about this important update. Latif, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So something that you sought to learn in the podcast series was how Nasser ended up imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay. What does the U.S. government say about that?
Well, that's part of the problem, as you said. Like, he's never been officially charged with anything. We know from leaked documents from over a decade ago, basically what they thought this guy did. You know, there's a pretty nefarious laundry list of things: being a top explosives expert for Al Qaeda, being a top military advisor to Osama bin Laden, blowing up the UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Bamiyan Buddha statues, fighting the U.S. and coalition forces at the Battle of Tora Bora. So there's a big list there that we know from these DOD documents from over a decade ago.
So he's been there. He was there for almost two decades, held at Guantanamo. What was his experience like there?
His experience was he wasn't waterboarded. He was exposed to treatment that I think many people would call torture, including sleep deprivation, prolonged solitary confinement, exposure to extreme heat or cold, loud noises, sensory overload. He has hearing, long-term hearing damage because of that. But yeah, I think that was probably more early on in his time there. But ever since then, I mean, he's just one of 40 guys out of prison.
And he was supposed to go back to Morocco now 5 years ago, right? He was approved to be sent back to Morocco back in 2016. Why did that not happen?
So he got approved unanimously by six big agencies in the United States government to leave Guantanamo in 2016. Basically, what happens is during the sort of tail end of the Obama administration, the thing that keeps him at Guantanamo is paperwork, basically. There's this bureaucratic log and diplomatic log jam. And basically, at the end, the thing he needed was a signature from the Secretary of Defense, which he just didn't get. And so he was sort of kept there by paperwork. And that made it so he couldn't get out in the Obama administration. Then the Trump administration came in. You just played the tape of what President Trump wanted to do with Guantanamo, not let people out, but load it up. He did let one guy out, but that was to a Saudi prison. So in terms of detainees, it was pretty much the same under Donald Trump. And then now, over the last 6 months, it's just been a matter of, I think, the Biden administration kind of getting together who and what they want to do with and their strategy about what they want to do about Guantanamo.
You make the point about the detainee who was released under President Trump into a Saudi prison. What is our understanding about what lies ahead for Nasser? Apparently, his lawyers say that that there's an expectation he'll be reunited with his family, but I'm wondering about the other legal battles that he will face in Morocco.
Yeah, so there's sort of pending an investigation pending on, and I got the language here, his alleged involvement in the perpetration of terror acts in Morocco. So all the former Guantanamo detainees that were released to Morocco kind of were also investigated in this way, whether it's kind of a real serious investigation that could mean that, you know, he is facing more prison time. That's a question. Or is this kind of just a perfunctory thing to say, okay, let's just, you know, review this guy? It's unclear at this point, but he is still technically under investigation in Morocco.
So I'm wondering about, he was not the only detainee cleared to leave back during the Obama administration. I'm wondering if you currently have any sense as to whether or not others who were cleared to leave under that administration will have an opportunity to be repatriated, or why it was Nasser who was the first.
Yeah, as of now, after Abdel-Latif Nasser left, there are 10 more guys who are in this position where on paper, basically, they're allowed to go, but they just can't. Basically, the reason why I think Abdel-Latif Nasser was the first for the Biden administration is that one of the folks I talked to who sort of put together that transfer package, he said it's not that Abdel-Latif Nasser was low-hanging fruit. Abdel-Latif Nasser was no-hanging fruit. He was the whole package was totally put together. It was really just that kind of final bureaucratic say-so that was preventing him from getting out. So I think that was sort of the easiest layup in terms of a transfer that they could do.
So you were just talking about someone who you spoke with as part of the series, but of course you did not get to speak with Abdel-Latif Nasser himself because he was being held in Guantanamo. Does the fact that he's now in Morocco raise any possibility that you might actually have that opportunity to continue reporting by speaking directly with him?
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. In my experience with this series, trying to interview released Guantanamo detainees, they've been the most sort of difficult sources I've had in my career as a journalist. Both getting access, getting them to agree to want to sit down for an interview, which, you know, to them feels like another interrogation, you know. And then the interviews themselves are very, very sort of delicate, given that there's so much kind of trauma in the air. So I very much would like to interview him, but I'm approaching it as carefully as I can.
As you talk about that sort of journalistic ethic about how careful you need to be and how, you know, maybe determined you need to be in finding this source and having an opportunity to speak with this source, I'm wondering about the story in general. I mean, part of the reason you made the series was because Guantanamo had largely fallen off the radar. You know, our attention was tuned towards lots of other things. But one might suggest, perhaps maybe particularly the Biden administration, that a quieter approach might be more valuable to them. So I'm in terms of actually getting these approved detainees released, I'm wondering about the balance that you see between telling the stories versus sort of holding back a bit on the stories because of the politics.
I've heard that argument before, and I think probably strategically, tactically for the administration, that sort of makes sense. I could see you making the opposite argument as well, but I do think for me and for my team, it's our job as journalists to shine a light in this, you know, on this black hole, this legal black hole. I think it's important for us to to say, even, you know, almost 20 years later, holding people for 19 years without charges, without a trial, torturing them, that is medieval. That's wrong. We have to all keep witnessing that. There are sort of political tactics, but I think that, like, for us, we're journalists. Sunlight, you know, sunlight has value.
Disinfectant.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we all, like, this is what has gone on legally. Like, that's a pre-modern thing. That's a pre-Magna Carta thing to hold people for that long and not charge them with anything. And that's not okay.
I'm thinking also that at times journalists are taught that that the best way to report stories is with as much personal distance as possible, to be sort of the most objective. And yet the series is so rooted in your own interest here, and your own interest, not ideologically, but literally because you all share a name, and because that shared name has meaning, perhaps even for your experience in the U.S. I'm wondering if you can talk about the journalism associated with telling a story about the other Latif.
Yeah, it was a deeply personal story, way more personal than any story I've ever done. And compounding that, both the questions of religion and identity and, you know, why we believe and act the way we do. While reporting this series, I was becoming a citizen and studying for my civics exam and thinking about, you know, questions of due process and equal rights and things like that. And just seeing this man's story sort of buck all those values that this country is supposed to stand for, you know what I mean? And for me to be personally signing up for that, it felt weird.
Latif Nasser is one of the co-hosts for Radiolab and lead reporter for the Radiolab series, The Other Latif. Latif, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
With me now is someone who's reported closely on Guantanamo from the base itself for years. Carol Rosenberg is the Guantanamo reporter for the New York Times. Carol, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
Thank you for including me.
Can you talk a little bit about the status of other detainees who have been cleared for release under the Obama administration?
There are four other men at Guantanamo among the 39 detainees who were in a similar situation to Abdellatif Nasser. One, Soufiane Barhoumi of Algeria, had been in an absolute similar situation, meaning diplomats had arranged for his repatriation and he should have been going home in the very tail end of the Obama administration. But something went wrong. Just like Abdellatif, the arrangements came in too late, and he has sat there throughout the entire Trump administration because during Trump, they've just basically ended all transfers but one. During the Trump administration, they sent one man, a convicted terrorist, to Saudi Arabia, to prison. So there were four others like Abdellatif, but three of them really never had arrangements to go anywhere. The situation as of today is there are 10 men among the 39 for whom the Biden administration needs to find countries to take them in, either in some instance repatriate them, or in other instances find rehabilitation programs to absorb them.
So you reported earlier this month that officials in the Biden administration are divided on whether the Justice Department should take the position that Guantanamo detainees actually have due process rights. What is the nature of this disagreement?
Well, at the end of the day, they took no position. They decided to, I guess that's a measure of just how divided they were. The ability of the U.S. government to hold someone as a law of war detainee at Guantanamo in what is coming up on year 20 of this war with Afghanistan relies to a certain degree on legal definitions. They are held as war prisoners. With one exception down there, nobody is convicted of a crime, but 10 or 11 are awaiting trial. So the question of whether someone is entitled to due process would be significant for the men who are held as war prisoners, no charges, no release. The position, as a matter of law, the Biden administration has adopted the same legal positions as all of its predecessors, that this war on terror, this war that exists with Al-Qaeda, is bigger than the battlefield. When we leave, when the last troop leaves Afghanistan, they say the authority to detain someone as a prisoner on this war on terror continues. The pendulum of whether due process rights applies could help those men who are sort of like POWs in this war in the federal courts as they seek release. We had been watching, we had expected some sort of perhaps more liberal interpretation of what rights a detainee could use in order to get out of Guantanamo, and some sort of clarification in the death trials down there, the capital trials down there, on absolutely what evidence could apply. It didn't happen in this question over at the appeals court on the, in the due process challenge. And so they took no position, which was a surprise, but in a way a little bit different than the previous position that they had no due process rights.
Right. So there wasn't an affirmative statement of the rights, but there also wasn't a clear sort of discourse that those rights don't exist. I'm wondering about that kind of non-position, because you've reported that the Biden administration is trying to be a bit more quiet in its transfer of detainees out of Guantanamo, in part having learned from the backlash that the Obama administration experienced. And yet, here you and I are talking about it on the radio, in part because you wrote about it in the New York Times. So is it really quiet?
The due process clause question really is about this administration retaining the prerogative to hold people as a matter of law. But as a matter of policy behind the scenes, quietly, I guess you could say, there's a ton of brainstorming going on. How to get people out, where to send them, who to put on trial. They haven't backed away from any of the trials, but there's three men who have yet to be arraigned down there. So there's different pockets of government deciding how to achieve, if at all possible, President Biden's aspiration to close Guantanamo. Closing Guantanamo means not leaving the base, but stopping the prison, picking up and moving those detainees elsewhere. In some instances, sending them to other countries. In other instances, they would need to bring them to the United States.
So as part of this sort of delay, obviously there was the Obama administration's attempt, and then, you know, we had a Trump administration in between, but there was also, and there is continuing, a global pandemic. I know you were away for about 500 days and then returned last week to report from the base. Can you talk about what Guantanamo has been like during the pandemic?
Sure. It was like locked in time. The guards came and went. You know, there's over 1,000 Army National Reserve troops down there working at this prison, which now has 39 detainees. They would continue their 9-month rotations, but the court was closed. The legal the legal proceedings came to a full stop. The media was not allowed, as you said, for 500 days. I left in February 2020 and was just allowed to return for the first media visit at last week. They managed to get the construction going. So the place is one big construction zone. There's a $125 million barracks for 850 of those prison guards to live in during their stays going up. That's a Trump administration program. So in a sense, for the period of the pandemic, let's say Guantanamo was status quo. Nothing changed for the detainees. Nothing changed in terms of, let's say, the guard program. They did have quarantines as people came in, but all the personalities changed. There's a new commander down there. There's new guards down there. There's new captain of the base. And so as a result, when Guantanamo reopens itself to the world and we go back down for hearings, the only people who've seen a hearing the last time it occurred are the prisoners, the press, and the lawyers. Even the judges are new coming in to hear these cases.
You have been reporting from Guantanamo for a very long time, even before the first detainees were sent there. Just sort of from how you're feeling, you know, being, again, having gone back after 500 days, do you think that the closure of the prison complex there can actually happen relatively soon?
It certainly cannot happen relatively soon. It cannot. The release of Abdulatif Nasser was one of the easiest transfers available to this administration. It had been done by diplomats of the Obama years. This administration was candid in which they said they used the same arrangements that had been made during the Obama years, and it took them for some reason 7 months, or in the intervening 7 months when the president took over, to get the Moroccan government to affirm it. There is tremendous amount of hard work to come, and a tremendous amount of politics to make some hard decisions about what to do in individual cases, and what to do with individual prisoners. For this detention center to close, there would have to be thousands upon hours of diplomacy, some willingness of Congress to let the Defense Department, the administration, move some of these detainees to a U.S. soil setting. As quietly as they are making arrangements for things, there can be change, there can be releases, but there is a very high hurdle to the notion that they can get the last detainee out of Guantanamo and send him somewhere else.
Carol Rosenberg is the Guantanamo reporter for the New York Times. Carol, thank you so much.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper, with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, everybody, this is The Takeaway, and I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. The Bucks NBA Finals have put the city of Milwaukee in the spotlight, where the Bucks play the Phoenix Suns tonight in Game 6 of the Finals. For the first time in 50 years, the Bucks have a chance at the championship, and if they win tonight, the Bucks will clinch the victory in their home city. This means a lot to a lot of Milwaukeeans who are coming together to celebrate this, especially some Milwaukee public school students who had their own basketball season canceled due to COVID-19. And we got a call from Jason Rosenbaum, a colleague over at St. Louis Public Radio, who had this to say.
I've been a Bucks fan for nearly 30 years. Even though I'm from the Chicago suburbs originally, I fell in love with the team after my dad took me to a game in the 1990s when most of the Bulls games were sold out. They've either been terrible, or mediocre, or are heartbreakingly disappointing. So this year, when they made it to the finals, I didn't really think twice about buying two tickets to the game. And it was a real full circle moment when my dad and I got to watch them win what is now their first of three victories in this series. So if they win on Tuesday, it would be by far the biggest sports moment of my life.
Speaking of full circle, Brandon Joseph, the Dean of Students and head varsity boys basketball coach at Carmen Northwest High School in Milwaukee, recognized a need in his community, and he brought the community together to create a basketball league of their own called City on the Floor. He's here to talk with us right now about basketball, the Bucks, and what this NBA final means for Milwaukee. Welcome to the show, Brandon.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
This is an exciting moment, I got to say, as somebody who was living in New Orleans when we won the Super Bowl right after Hurricane Katrina. There is something kind of special about the ways that that a championship can, like, you know, make you feel like, all right, we're going to make it through.
Most definitely. And I think what it actually does in entirety, it brings a city and a state together, all walks of life, enjoying, cheering for one common goal. I just think it's marvelous.
So speaking of coming together for a common goal, Milwaukee Public Schools didn't have a basketball season this year. So how did you make a decision to create your own season?
In all actuality, I was receiving phone calls from a lot of players, parents, just they were concerned. And the biggest concern was that other counties were playing. And we really had no answer at the time. But I was just, it was a lot of sleepless nights where it's like, man, something has to happen for these kids, not only just to give them sports, but we all know during the most traumatic time of the history of our world, they need an outlet during that time. So I got along with three other individuals, and we, you know, pretty much devised a plan so they can have a safe outlet through basketball. Did it happen here? No, it was actually 45 miles away because gyms were closed here. But we devised a plan to kind of be able to provide these opportunities for youth, student athletes at that time.
In a way that feels real Milwaukee to me, like just figuring out a way to make it happen, even if you don't have all the resources you need.
Most definitely. I think Milwaukee is a good down home, get it out the mud type of city. And you're absolutely right. When adversity hits, we utilize adversity to build character and to devise strategies so we can assist our families and assist our community.
Tell me a little bit more about the program. How, you know, sort of what were the age groups and how were you guys getting 45 minutes away? Were you carpooling? How did this all work?
We just put everything you just said just pretty much together. We had a transportation system for them where they actually the game days, we utilize a template where, you know, through email, you know, if you need a ride, we'll tell you the two stops the shuttle will be at, and then you can go and utilize that as a ride 45 minutes away. In regards to the age group, it was all high school because predominantly, even though our middle school population was affected as well, our high school population was, you know, at arm's reach from us. So it was all high school groups. And, you know, a lot of them got with their friends and just said, hey, let's play in this league. You know, we're not doing nothing from X time to X time at the virtual school. Let's utilize this league as a, you know, outlet and be able to socialize and fellowship together and a common goal of trying to win it.
So I've been listening to some of the kind of national sports talking heads, and on ESPN's First Take recently, somebody took a shot at Milwaukee by calling it, quote, a terrible city compared to other cities that the finals have been hosted in. Do you want to say something about Milwaukee?
Being born and raised here, you know, initially you listen to those type of comments and it immediately gets to you. But after processing it now, after seeing it being observed in the national spotlight, I'm hoping those certain individuals eat those words, because at the end of the day, Milwaukee is traditionally just a homegrown city where, especially when adversity hits or comments like that try to serve as a stigma for what we do down here, it kind of motivates us to come together and be able to be united and show the world that we're no different than anybody else. We just want to root for our hometown team and live life like everyone else.
Now, Milwaukee has had challenges that many other American cities have faced as well. Challenges around race, around housing segregation, policing, violence, all of those issues. And yet it feels like the Bucks in the finals has at least brought the city together in some kind of ways. We've been talking about Black joy a lot this summer. Have you been seeing some Black joy in Milwaukee?
Oh, most definitely. I think the Bucks have been that, I call it a positive distraction. So some of the things that's been going on, it's just been a positive distraction. And they at least give us, if they're playing two times a week, they give us those 6 hours out the week where, you know, you can come together all walks of life and enjoy a spirit of, you know, just one to actually root for your hometown team. So for 6 hours out the week, you get a time to enjoy some quality basketball.
What have your players, your teenagers, been telling you about how they're feeling about the Bucks in the finals?
If I'm a teenager around this time, the level of excitement that I have will be at an all-time high. In terms of knowing, you know, the majority of teenagers I know I work with and the challenges and the deficiencies that they don't have any choice to basically sometime that they're born into, it would give me a sense of hope. You know, and like I said, I not only just for being a basketball player, but if you want to be a carpenter, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be a doctor, it shows that if you come together, you play your role, you work hard, you can make the championship, not only probably, you know, like I'm saying, in the basketball world, but your form of life. So Bucks can right now are serving as ambassadors, just showing that we weren't always this good. But guess what we did? We worked our butts off to be this good. And if I'm a teenager at this time, sky's the limit. I'm ready to go to college. I'm ready to go to my trade school. I'm ready to conquer the world because the Bucks did it.
Are you watching tonight? And how are you going to celebrate if there's a win?
Am I watching tonight?
I know. It's a ridiculous question. I get it.
I'm front row and center. Me and some of my better friends. We're getting the devising the plan as we speak. And We're going to kind of embrace the community and the and our friendships and just be united. I think we deserve it.
Brandon Joseph is the Dean of Students and Head Varsity Boys Basketball Coach at Carmen Northwest High School in Milwaukee. He's also an organizer for City on the Floor, and he's got big plans for tonight. Thanks for being here, Brandon.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Disability is the only identity group that anybody can join at any time. And that's not a threat. That's actually something that I think is pretty cool. Anyone can become part of this community. And so when you're thinking about it from that perspective, why wouldn't you want to create a world that's better for disabled people?
You're listening here to Emily Liddell. She's a disability rights activist and author, and we're going to be hearing more from Emily a bit later in the show. Hers is an important insight. All of us, through age, through changing life conditions, and through family members and friends, might become part of the vibrant community of people living with disabilities. So for the rest of this hour, we're going to spend a little time in this diverse community. First, one of the biggest challenges, poverty. People with disabilities are more vulnerable to poverty, and data from the last decade show that a full two-thirds of those experiencing long-term poverty have a disability. One reason is because Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, our national program for adults who've never been able to work and don't qualify for Social Security, doesn't even reach the poverty line. In May of last year, President Biden's platform included a major expansion of SSI benefits. But the reality of implementing that platform is complicated. Here to discuss is Dylan Matthews, a reporter at Vox, covering economic policy. Dylan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
So help folks to understand a little bit about why SSI exists.
So SSI exists to provide a sort of economic floor for elderly people and people with disabilities. It was created in the early 70s, and sort of the central premise was that while welfare for people of working age was still incredibly politically controversial, as it remains today, there was sort of a bipartisan commitment that if you were elderly, if you were living with a disability, you should not be living in poverty. And if you're in a group where you could not or were too old to work, that you should be protected from extreme material deprivation. And so it's important just to provide a base, but also because it helps people who have been left out of the traditional Social Security system. To get Social Security, either due to old age or disability, you typically have to have worked a sufficient length of time, earned a sufficient amount of money, because it's an insurance program, you pay into it. SSI isn't like that. It's meant to help people who sort of would have fallen through the cracks of that system. And so people who struggled to get employment much of their career, who worked low-income jobs throughout their career. So it's really helping people that the rest of the safety net doesn't.
So why are the payments set at a level for so many that actually doesn't even reach the poverty threshold?
So I think it's a combination of an inertia and sort of cost cutting by Congress that SSI, unlike Social Security, isn't directly funded through payroll taxes. It doesn't have a dedicated funding base. It's paid out of the general budget that Congress considers. And it's a pretty vulnerable program because people with disabilities often don't have a lot of political power. That's changed with the disability rights movement to some degree, but it's a vulnerable group and sort of in the past was easier to run roughshod over. So over the years, Congress just sort of started to neglect it. Benefits were not sometimes indexed properly to changes in lifestyle, to economic growth. And so you saw this degradation of benefits and eventually the situation we're in now where you're far below the poverty line, even if you're getting full benefits from SSI.
So how likely is it that the Biden administration can create an expansion in this program?
So technically, it's incredibly possible. They just changed the amount of money that SSI gives out to people. Politically, it's a little tougher. They're trying to put together this bill that's currently about $3.5 trillion over 10 years. That includes everything from pre-K to childcare to subsidies for clean energy to assistance for home and community-based care for people with disabilities. And so this is one item in a long, long list of things that Democrats want to get done. And so I think the tricky thing for disability advocates and advocates for elderly people is making sure that it's on that list, that it gets its slice of the package that the Democrats are putting together. And so far, the Biden administration has been a little noncommittal. They proposed this last year during the campaign. You haven't heard a lot about it from them since, but there are a lot of very vocal advocates in Congress, people like Sherrod Brown, Jamal Bowman, who's a congressman from New York, where many of your listeners may be. And so there's a large push in Congress and among advocates to include this. So the number I've heard from people in Congress I talked to is 50-50. It could happen, it could not, but a lot depends on what happens in the next few weeks.
Sometimes the best political strategy for moving something like this is to talk very little about it in public, right? To actually sort of move it through with all of these other big items that you're talking about. Is that sort of the political calculus here, or is it that this is the kind of thing that needs more amplification and more public understanding?
I think it's a great question, and I think there are good arguments within advocacy on both sides of it. It's in some ways an ideal topic for secret Congress, as that process is sometimes called, in that it's not on the top of many voters' minds, but a small and dedicated group of advocates care very, very deeply about it. And so they might be able to attach it to bigger things. At the same time, the disability rights community, I think, especially in 2017, when Congress was considering repealing the Affordable Care Act, was very, very public. They were doing sit-ins in Congress, getting arrested, really sort of trying to publicly embarrass Republican members of Congress who might pull Medicare benefits away from them and millions of other Americans. They got a lot of results from that. I think if you talk to people in the healthcare world, they will give the disability community an incredible amount of credit for efforts to repeal Obamacare failing in 2017. So I'm sort of two minds on this, that on the one hand, there's a path that's kind of quiet, but on the other hand, the disability rights movement is a really incredible force. And when it's very active and loud, it can get a lot of stuff done.
Dylan Matthews is a reporter at Vox covering economic policy and also apparently covering secret Congress. Dylan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ah! we're listening to the godfather of soul, the late, great James Brown, declaring he is black and proud. Released in 1968, this funky protest anthem is a reminder of the importance of collective pride. Remember that communities who are shunned, shamed, and shunted to the margins must resist not only inequitable public policies, they must also resist mainstream messages suggesting that they are inadequate. I'm black and I'm proud. Gay pride. In the month of July, disability pride. Disability Pride Month, first recognized by New York City in 2015 to honor the 25th anniversary of the passage of the landmark Americans with Disabilities Act, asserts in no uncertain terms that people with disabilities do not need to be fixed, cured, or healed. Disabled folk aren't waiting on a miracle. Disabled folk are miraculous. Since 2015, people across the U.S. have celebrated Disability Pride Month every July, though it has yet to be recognized formally at the federal level.
Many disability activists around the country recognize Disability Pride Month, and my hope is that it will eventually become a fixture in the months that we honor to celebrate diverse identities.
Emily Liddow is a disability rights activist and author of the forthcoming book, Demystifying Disability. Here's what Emily told me about the connection between disability and pride and why it's important to call the month Disability Pride Month instead of something like Disability History or Awareness Month.
I often think of the term awareness as something that we use when we're talking about something that we want to solve, a problem to be fixed, right? And disability is not a problem to be fixed. It's a culture. It's an identity. It's something that so many of us celebrate. And indeed, there is a history. So Disability History Month would certainly be in order to celebrate. But the history is what leads us to feeling pride in who we are. And for us, that's so incredibly hard won, especially in a society that doesn't want to celebrate disability, that sees it as a negative thing. And so by calling it Disability Pride Month, we're really reclaiming the power in the word disability, in the identity of disability.
I want you to push on that, you know, for just a bit more with me, because I do think that at least for some listeners, it'll catch them off guard to hear you say, oh yeah, disability isn't a problem to be solved.
We have been socialized to understand disability solely from a negative perspective, right? Disability is something that is wrong with a person. Disability is something that is bad, that happened to you, that we want to get rid of and eliminate from society. That's what we've been told. But disability activists are saying, no, that's not true. Let's flip the script. Disability is actually something that has brought so much depth and richness to our existence. That's not to say that it's always easy to be disabled. Certainly, I don't want to give anyone the impression that my life or the lives of other disabled people is always sunshine and roses and easy, because we live in a society that doesn't accept us for who we are. But at the same time, by embracing disability, by recognizing that it's something we can celebrate and something that makes us part of a community, I think that's what we need to do to start shifting away from these negative attitudes towards disability.
Imagine having pride and experiencing human depth in an identity that is not well accepted by the broader population. Just shocking, huh?
It's a powerful pushback to the common narratives that we hear, and I understand why it would give people pause. And for that matter, it gives me pause sometimes. I have a lot that I grapple with within my own body, within my own existence. Sometimes I internalize the way that people think about disability. And so it's challenging to feel pride, but pride is not just about celebrating who you are as an individual. It's about recognizing that disabled people should be, just like any other diverse identity, a celebrated part of our community.
Now, talk about the diverse identity aspect. I think one of the pleasures, but also traps of, you know, February, Black History Month, of, you know, of June, LGBTQ Pride Month, is that for outsiders, it can sort of flatten community and presume that everyone with a particular identity is the same. So talk to me about the multiple variations and experiences that constitute disability communities.
That's so true. And I'm really glad that we're talking about this, because I want to very clearly acknowledge that I am a white woman, a cisgender woman, heterosexual. I use a wheelchair to get around. My disability is physical. And so I am not at all representative of what it means to be disabled. I'm one person in quite literally a billion disabled people around the globe. And so when I talk about disability, it comes very much from the way that disability has shaped my life. But we have to recognize the ways in which other identities intersect and connect with the disability experience. So I come from a place of having a lot of privilege in my experience, despite being someone of a marginalized identity. Disability intersects with any and all other identities. It's the only identity that can do that. And so when we're talking about disability, if we're ignoring the ways that other identities connect with disability, then we're simply not talking about the very real and diverse disability experience.
Let's talk about legislation, the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. Talk to me about how that has both shifted and what it's failed to do in the lives of people living with disabilities.
Disability advocates are still having many of the same conversations that they were having well before the ADA was implemented. And I often say that you can create policy, but you can't legislate an attitude change. And that's really the crux of the issue. The ADA is absolutely a crucial and vital law to have in place. But until we start shifting attitudes, it's almost impossible to get people to fully implement the policies, even though they're at this point about 31 years old. And so my particular fight, if you will, is constantly getting people to understand that, yes, the Americans with Disabilities Act is incredibly important. Accessibility is incredibly important. But we have to get people to the point of first accepting disability so that they'll understand why the implementation of legislation like the ADA is so crucial.
So in your forthcoming book, Demystifying Disability, you write about how many people, specifically the non-disabled, don't know how to act around disabled people, or they don't know what to say. Can you talk a little bit about why that is, maybe, and some of the ways that that we can address those issues within broader life?
There's such a great fear of the unknown, and disability is considered the unknown. It's something that people see and they say, I don't want that to happen to me, or I can't imagine my life like that. And so because of that unfamiliarity and because of that feeling of discomfort and potentially knowing that it could happen to you and seeing that as a bad thing, people aren't really sure how to behave around disabled people. We're pushed away and treated as the other. But I tell people that disability etiquette is really not that complicated. Just be yourself. There's no reason to go out of your way to be nice to someone with a disability, but also there's no reason to be rude to someone with a disability. Act the way that you would when you're interacting with anybody else.
It's worth pointing out that so far in the conversation, we've talked about disability as though it is, you know, 0-1 box. Either you're a person with a disability or you're a person living without a disability. But over the course of our lifetimes, those of us who typically might be living without disability might in our elder years or might as a result of illness or injury become people living with disability, at least for some period of our lives. How might those experiences of actually experiencing disability impact our ability to be, as non-disabled folks, people who are behaving, I almost hate the word ally, but in good ally or co-conspiratorial relationships?
Disability is the only identity group that anybody can join at any time. And that's not a threat. That's actually something that I think is pretty cool. Anyone can become part of this community. And so when you're thinking about it from that perspective, why wouldn't you want to create a world that's better for disabled people, knowing that one day that world might also make your life better and easier? And there's a phrase that some people like to use, temporarily able-bodied, meaning that, as you mentioned, at some point in our lives, we're likely going to experience some kind of disability. Now, I don't necessarily mean to say that if you have broken a bone, that you are suddenly a complete expert on the disability experience. I've had so many people say to me, oh, well, I broke my leg, and so I was in a wheelchair for 6 weeks, and now I totally get the disability experience. That's not quite what we're asking. But what we are asking is that if there is a change that happens in your body, why not contribute now to making the world easier so that if and when that change happens, the world is a better, more livable place for you and for everybody?
Yeah, I'm thinking in this moment, I'm the youngest of five, but my second oldest sister lost her sight to MS in her early 30s and became a person living, you know, with the definition of legal blindness or without sight. And it certainly changed not only my perspective, but that of, you know, of our family who'd never had someone very close in our family who was living without sight. And all of a sudden, a wide variety of issues from public transportation to work opportunities, right, all became kind of part of how we were managing life in a very different way. Can we talk for a minute about language? How should we be talking about disability when we're having these conversations, particularly maybe in a public policy sphere?
Well, first, I just wanted to thank you for sharing about your sister. And I think that really highlights that everybody knows somebody who's disabled, whether or not they identify. Disability is something that impacts one in four American adults. And so we have to recognize that this is not just something that we should push to the wayside. Disability is very much a part of the human experience. And that means that when we talk about disability, we need to know the right words to use, but there's a lot of confusion around that. And I really understand that because there isn't one right way to talk about disability and there isn't one right way for people to identify. What I like to tell people is that disability itself is not a bad word. Disability is, in fact, what I have. Disabled is what I am. There are many people who prefer to say person with a disability and put the person first. There are many people who prefer to put their identity first and say disabled person. And I embrace saying disabled person, but I know that's not everybody's choice. And then I'd also just add very briefly that it's really important to consider not using words that avoid saying disability. We often hear special needs and differently abled and physically challenged. Those words aren't really getting to the heart of it. Disability is what it is. It's not a bad word.
Emily Ladau is a disability rights activist and author of the forthcoming book, Demystifying Disability. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Another day in the can, y'all. And don't forget to check out what happens with those butts tonight. Enjoyed being here with you as always. And be sure to come on back tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.